From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone, and in this most partisan of seasons, we're devoting this show to a consideration of a charge often lobbed at public broadcasting, especially NPR, liberal bias. For instance, here's former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu, with whom I recently discussed a discredited Romney campaign ad slamming President Obama for gutting welfare reform.
As usual, you, part of the liberal press that will cover this president's butt across the board, you're going to lose in November. But I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
As I said, it's a common charge, being biased in favor of liberals. But is it accurate? We pursued this question last year after a series of unfortunate events. First, NPR's extremely public and impolitic decision to terminate the contract of NPR political analyst, also Fox News commentator, Juan Williams, because of feelings he expressed on Fox News. That fanned the flames of Fox rage.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. A disgraceful decision by the National Public Radio outfit that is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. NPR has fired Juan Williams.
Here's Fox commentator and GOP strategist Karl Rove.
For the National Progressive Radio to fire him for deviating from their political correctness is shame on the National Public Radio. Shame on them.
Anyway, that sort of thing. Then 5 months later, NPR senior vice president for fundraising, Ron Schiller, was caught in a sting, saying embarrassingly partisan things.
The current Republican Party, particularly the Tea Party, is fanatically involved in people's personal lives and very fundamental Christian, and I wouldn't even call it Christian, it's this weird evangelical.
Ron Schiller resigned, followed by NPR president Vivian Schiller, no relation. But it didn't diminish the GOP's desire to kill public broadcasting's federal funding.
It should not be the taxpayers' responsibility to fund news organizations with a partisan point of view.
I think it's right that the CEO stepped down. It would be more right, though, if we seize this time of a fiscal crisis to say it's time to end public funding for NPR.
Where isn't the Constitution says the federal government's supposed to be funding competition for private networks with a public television or public radio in any way?
Those were Republican members of the House, Eric Cantor and Mike Pence, and Senator Tom Coburn. NPR receives only about 2% of its income directly from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the federal funding arm. That money goes mostly to stations that pay dues to NPR for programs. CPB provides roughly 10% of the public radio economy, but for small stations in rural communities, it can supply more than 30% of their budgets. The content of public broadcasting has at some point or other annoyed every administration since its inception. But despite the bipartisan irritation its journalism engenders, Republican legislators invariably lead the charge to kill the CPB. So far, they've failed because a majority of voters, including Republican voters, value public broadcasting. Still, the fight continues decade after decade.
I spent a lot of time as president of NPR trying to reduce the share of the budget that was contributed by the government.
Frank Mankiewicz was NPR's president from 1977 to 1983 after stints as campaign director for George McGovern and press secretary to Senator Robert Kennedy. A liberal, to be sure, but one so eager to reduce NPR's reliance on government, he launched programs that caused a huge budget gap, spawning NPR's financial crisis in 1983. And that's when public funding was rerouted from NPR to the stations. Now Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney is on the record in favor of defunding public broadcasting. And it seems to be the reflex of the NPR board to fire any member of its staff who raises hackles in Washington, reigniting the argument over funding. Is that response the act of a mature, confident news organization? For instance, should it have fired NPR President Vivian Schiller? Frank Mankiewicz says no.
I don't think that this event should have been responsible for her firing. I think she was a very competent executive and was taking NPR in the right direction.
John Stewart called NPR's board a bunch of pussies.
A bunch of what?
Pussies.
Cookies?
Pussies.
Oh, pussies. Yeah, that may be true.
So that brings us to this hour. As I mentioned at the top, last year we produced a series to explore that charge of liberal bias. This week, we've edited the highlights of that series together into a single hour. And it all started with a visit from This American Life's Ira Glass.
Hey, guys.
Ira Glass, host of This American Life.
As I live and breathe.
So, Ira, what are you doing here?
Well, are you guys going to cover, like, the thing that nobody talks about in this whole debate over defunding public radio, or at least nobody in public radio talks about it, which is...
The elephant in the room?
Yes. All the conversations about defunding public radio, if you look at the lobbying effort that public radio and public TV have mounted, they had this campaign called 170 million, and there's a website, and it's all about how 170 million Americans each month listen to public radio or watch public TV, and we're all in this together, and that includes a lot of conservatives. And I feel like it completely sidesteps the actual substance of the main attack on public radio, and that is the attack that we have a left-wing liberal bias. Can I play you guys a clip?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. This is Bill O'Reilly from Fox News, which is the source of most of this.
NPR has now devolved into a totalitarian outfit functioning as an arm of the far left. There's no question about that.
That's funny. That same video clip was played at our conference call this morning with Kim Jong-il when he gave us our marching orders.
Okay, so Ira, what's your beef then, really? Is it that public radio itself is not willing to take this on? Because about 25 years ago, I was asked to do a piece, is NPR biased to the left? And I couldn't find a metric to apply to the question in order to answer it.
I don't know the methodology somebody would use, but I feel like public radio should address this directly, because I think anybody who listens to our stations understands that what they're hearing is mainstream media reporting. We have nothing to fear from a discussion of what is the news coverage we're doing. As somebody who works in public radio, it is killing me that people on the right are going around trying to basically rebrand us, saying that it's biased news, it's left-wing news, when I feel like anybody who listens to the shows knows that it's not, and we are not fighting back. We're not saying anything back. I find it completely annoying, and I don't understand it.
Okay, so this gets back to not only Brooke's problem finding a metric to report on this story, but it's especially difficult when you and I both know that if you were to somehow poll the political orientation of everybody in the NPR news organization and at all of the member stations, you would find a progressive, liberal crowd, not uniformly, but overwhelmingly.
Journalism in general, reporters tend to be Democrats and tend to be more liberal than the public as a whole. Sure. But that doesn't change what is going out over the air. And I feel like, well, let's measure the product. And you're saying, what's the metric that we can measure the product on? I would say, go through, you know, this morning's Morning Edition and find me even a sentence that smells like political bias to you. Like find one. And, you know, the problem with this, can I just keep talking or do you need
sure.
to get questions
in here?
Sure,
no, go ahead.
Here? Okay. So I've actually talked to the people who run that lobbying campaign for public radio and asked, like, how come we're not defending our brand? How come we're not arguing on the question of left-wing bias? And they say, well, as a political fight, it's a really hard one because you can get into this kind of he said, she said, where if the other side can find one crazy example, it becomes very hard to argue. So they're like, let's stay away from that when we're lobbying Congress. But at the same time, there's a sense, and I've talked to some people at NPR and at our distributor, PRI, where there's a sense of, like, we need to when this political fight is done, we need to actually go out and reassert, here's who we are with the audience. And in fact, Vivian Schiller, president of NPR, who quit this week, on Monday, she gave a speech at the National Press Club, which was an opening salvo in that, where she basically made a speech saying, like, we are mainstream media. This is not left-wing media. I just think that that is not enough of the messaging. And I don't even exactly know if I'm using the word messaging right here. But
okay, Ira, what do you want us to do?
Well, on the media, you are the perfect vehicle for this. You were made for this purpose, to measure the political bias of public radio. It needs to be done. You are the only ones. You are the ones best positioned of everyone in the country, in the public radio system, in the world to do this mission, and I hand it to you. It's an urgent mission, and it needs to be done and done beautifully.
What if the answer is yes, NPR has a left-wing bias?
It's not going to be yes.
What if the answer is it doesn't have a left-wing bias? Is that going to change anyone's mind?
Well, there are certain people you're never going to change their mind, and there are certain people who are capitalizing for political gain on the thought that it's a biased network. But the fact is that I think there's a persuadable group of people who are ready to hear that message, if you could come up with the proof.
Yeah, one more thing, though, and this is one of those genie back-in-the-bottle things. No matter what methodology you choose and no matter what the results are, for now and forever, people can point to Ron Schiller in the Sting tape running his mouth and confirming all of the most sinister thoughts anybody in the Republican Party has ever had.
The thing that I would note is that Ron Schiller was not saying it on our air. He's not a reporter, and you would never hear anything like that from any of our reporters. How do you counter that? With the truth, baby. With the truth. That's all we got. Listen to what we're doing on the air and measure it. Call it impractical. Call it idealistic. But I have to believe if we get out there with the truth, that that weapon is a real weapon and actually means something.
Ira?
Yes?
That's impractical, unrealistic, and naive.
But you'll do it.
Okay.
Okay. Coming up, journalism scholars, data wonks, and conservative critics.
I mean, heck, you wouldn't have gotten so many emails if I was completely barking up the wrong tree, would you?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with the second part of our special hour on liberal bias and public radio. After that conversation with Ira, both our shows were flooded with comments, so we proceeded to wade into the subject. It was, predictably enough, a quagmire. I mean, look no further than the terms themselves. What is bias? What do we mean when we invoke the term liberal? And even defining NPR is complicated. I mean, really complicated. So we started at what we thought was the beginning. Bias. It's a moving target. In his 1986 book, The Uncensored War, communications professor Daniel Hallin drew a simple diagram depicting three spheres in journalism. They're called Hallin's spheres. Picture a donut. The hole in the donut is the sphere of consensus, and here are issues and views we can all agree on. Democracy is good, slavery is bad, all men are created equal. Here, truths are self-evident, and journalists don't feel the need to be objective. No, that's reserved for the donut itself, the sphere of legitimate controversy. Here's where the bulk of journalism takes place. Gun control, interest rates, budget matters, and abortion. Issues on which reasonable people can disagree and where journalists are obliged to present both sides. Outside the donut lies the sphere of deviance, limbo, where viewpoints are deemed unworthy of debate. The pro-pedophilia position, for example, does not get a hearing in mainstream media. But Hallin created his spheres in the 1980s, before Fox News and MSNBC, the rise of talk radio and the blogosphere. Certain views that a generation ago would have been relegated to the sphere of deviance, for example, questioning the birth certificate of the President of the United States, Hallin says have now forced their way onto the donut.
When I made my diagram, there was only one set of spheres, let's say, and everybody kind of agreed on what they were. The boundaries might get fuzzy. But now I think our media have become fragmented and pluralized so that you have different sub-communities that have different ideas of where the boundaries lie, right? So a generation ago that questions whether Obama can legitimately be president, this would have been rejected both by elites in Washington of both parties and by the media as just absolutely outside the proper bounds of political debate, and it would have been excluded. Today, there's just a lot less consensus.
So Hallin's donut has been blasted into crumbs by a confluence of voices. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but where does that leave NPR?
NPR, like actually quite a few of the mainstream news organizations in the U.S., I would say still adheres to the old-style journalism that tries to stick to the center and tell both sides. But I think that this is a period in which it's harder to do. I think it's much more difficult to legitimize.
What do you mean it's more difficult to legitimize?
Well, you could convince people that you were, in fact, being neutral by sticking to a point in the center between Republicans and Democrats and giving them both a hearing in an earlier period. Nowadays, that just doesn't work as well because different segments of the population have different ideas of where the center really is, of what's a legitimate political point of view. So I think that all of the news organizations that try and stick to the old-fashioned patterns of journalistic professionalism, they're all a little bit on the defensive.
How do you think mainstream journalists should respond to the fuzziness of the sphere of consensus, the sphere of legitimate debate, and the sphere of deviance, that which should not be discussed?
At what point would we decide that global warming is not really a legitimate subject of controversy anymore? Because the truth is, within scientific communities, it's not. Within the political public sphere, there's still a big controversy about it. And that is somewhat troubling, that gap. You know, in many cases, I think it's going to be the right decision for journalists to say, we're aware that the science says that there's not a controversy here, and we're going to refuse to treat this part of it as though it were controversial. I think that that's a responsible decision. I think it's politically risky as well.
Daniel Hallin teaches at the University of California, San Diego. Based on the remark we just heard, he'll be labeled by some as a liberal. The word is applied broadly now to big L liberal politics and small L liberal values, even liberal science, to the point where the word liberal itself means almost nothing. And what does NPR mean? For most people, NPR is whatever they hear when they tune into public radio. But NPR itself produces or editorially oversees very little of that content. It's directly responsible for Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the weekend equivalent of those shows, and Talk of the Nation. It also distributes shows produced elsewhere, On the Media, Diane Rehm, Fresh Air, and so on. And then there are the shows that NPR neither produces nor distributes that are among public radio's most popular, This American Life, Marketplace, A Prairie Home Companion. And finally, there are the local shows produced by public radio stations everywhere. But does it even matter when most of the bias debate coalesces around federal support, the bulk of which goes to stations? Sam Negus is a libertarian evangelical Christian who listens to a lot of public radio. He wrote Ira that he values it, but he won't support it because of some crucial biases he hears. We asked him on to explain, and we had Ira back, too, to hear what irks Negus the most.
The political example that I gave you that stuck out in my mind most recently was from the Friday News Roundup this past Friday.
This is a Diane Rehm show.
They were a couple of journalists, and they started the show talking about the labor situation, obviously Wisconsin and Indiana. So the panelists were talking, and one of the first observations that one of the guests made was that the situation in Wisconsin would probably galvanize the American labor movement. And the tone of her voice told me very clearly that she was thrilled by that, which she has every right to be. What I didn't hear was another guest who shared my ideological concerns with the overarching goals of labor unionism, There was nobody there, I felt, speaking for the electorate of Wisconsin. The people of Wisconsin went to the polls and they returned the Wisconsin Democrats as the minority in the Senate. And what happens when you're in the minority is bills get passed that you don't like. That's democracy, you know.
So, Sam, can I ask you, I don't hear many of the talk shows during the day. Most of the public radio listening I hear is of the news programs. And so this morning's Morning Edition, here's what I heard. They had a lead story which was from Japan about what it's like right now for the people in the most devastated areas. Then there was a story from here in the U.S. which talked about nuclear power plants in the United States. And surprisingly, we're not really building many anymore because natural gas is so much cheaper. And then there's a story from Bahrain and an on-the-ground story about what's happening there. Then a story about Haley Barbour's run for the presidential nomination and his background and some very convincing things I thought that he said from the stump, and audiences saying what a great impression he made, and a summary of one early problem in his campaign. And then there was a report on new laws to restrict abortion, and that had a very standard sort of TikTok pro-choice, anti-abortion sides, of that thing. And, mm-hmm. and it just seemed very, very straight to me. It seemed like mainstream news coverage, very factual, a lot of on-the-ground reporting, a lot of context. And I guess the thing that I'm wondering is, do you feel like the things that you're hearing that are making you wince, is it really on the fringes? Is it really just now and then? Because to me, when I think of public radio, I feel like overwhelmingly it is like what I heard this morning on Morning Edition.
Right. Okay. So I listened to the same report this morning. I particularly listened to the abortion discussion because I knew we were going to be having this conversation this afternoon. And I thought, okay, let's see what they're saying here. You know, and I did think it was fair and balanced. There is a difference between NPR's kind of news coverage and the editorial stuff. I do see that bias less obviously in the news coverage. Maybe the best way to explain it would just be that there are assumptions. You can explain facts, but the way that you state facts or the way that you structure them, sometimes it's more than others, and sometimes it's because I'm sensitive. I'm aware of my own biases too. I understand sometimes I'm reading into questions hostility that isn't there, but sometimes it's definitely there. And I'll give you an example that my wife and I have kind of joked about a couple of times. We remember very clearly the morning after the 2006 midterms when the Democrats took back the House. It was just obvious that the anchors on Morning Edition and the other shows that followed were happy. You can't hide when you're happy, right?
Sam, another thing that you wrote me about was more of a cultural bias, and you wrote about something that you heard on Fresh Air.
Okay, so it was Good Friday, I think maybe 2 years ago. I turned on NPR. They had the radio on. It's almost always on to NPR if we're in the car. Terry Gross's show, Fresh Air, was on, and her guest was a co-founder of the Jesus Seminar. And the Jesus Seminar, for anyone who isn't familiar, the short version of what they believe that's offensive to me as an evangelical Christian is that Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead as a bodily historical fact, but that that's a kind of spiritual metaphor. Now, he can believe that. That's fine. I'm not about forcing anyone to believe anything. The point was that a co-founder of the Jesus Seminar was on that show on a national platform for a solid hour, unopposed. It wasn't a panel. That sent a message to me. And I think the thing that I said in my email, and maybe this is what stuck out to you, Ira, 99.99%, almost everybody in the world and everybody in the history of the world since the time of Christ to now who would identify themselves as a Christian would be deeply offended and upset by this perspective, and moreover, wouldn't consider this person to be a Christian.
Because he doesn't believe in the literal resurrection.
Christ himself said, you want to know who I am? The resurrection is who I am. I'm going to be killed, I'll be in the grave, and then I will rise again. That's the heart of my religion, which is the heart of my being. It's everything I am. And I don't mind that that person was on NPR. But I've listened to NPR for years, and I've heard many, many religious shows. And I have not once got to the end of the show and thought, man, I am so glad that that guy was on there. He said exactly what I wanted him to say.
So I understand that you're saying that there's this question of tone that you hear all the time on all the shows, the news shows and the non-news shows, the more the talk shows, But do you think the information that you're getting, by and large, is reliable?
Yeah, I wouldn't be listening to Morning Edition to get my daily news while I eat my Cheerios and have a cup of coffee if I didn't. I think it's excellent. But, I mean, heck, you wouldn't have gotten so many emails saying the same thing if I was completely barking up the wrong tree, would you?
Possibly, because constantly we get arguments that NPR is bending over backwards the other way from our mail. It happens all the time, which is why we'd like you to keep a diary. Would you do that for us?
Sure.
Oh, poor guy. He just wrote a letter and now he's being dragged into a multi-week project.
No, Ira, I'm
just 1 week.
It's fine. It's fine. I'm thrilled to actually have a response. I'm thrilled to think that someone within the organization cares.
As you just heard, Sam Negus finds much of the programming on public radio excellent. He listens at the breakfast table. He listens in the car. But he won't support it because of those moments he just described. But how to judge the service as a whole? It probably can't be done, but we said we'd try, so we called Tom Rosensteel, founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. He quantifies media for a living, so I asked him if he found measuring bias to be a particularly sticky wicket.
Yes, and there's all kinds of academic literature that we've looked at that suggests that that wicket is really very sticky. First of all, when you are going to say that something's biased, you have to have some sense then of what would be unbiased, what would be perfectly accurate on some subject. Even evaluating whether the coverage of a candidate is too positive or negative, you have to take into account, well, how is that candidate doing in the polls? A candidate that's winning an election is going to have more positive coverage than a candidate that's losing an election. And you have to somehow control for that. One other interesting thing on this question of journalistic bias that can be unconscious. The Philadelphia Inquirer a few years ago did a study because they were being attacked by pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli members of the community. So they had LSU do a study of their coverage of the Middle East. And the research came back and said, you do have a bias in your coverage. It's a pro-peace bias. You favor whichever side at any given moment is looking for a ceasefire. The problem with that is that the people who are advocating violence at any given moment are doing so for a reason. They're not crazy necessarily. They might be wrong or they might be right, but these are tactics. And when you are always pushing for there shouldn't be violence, you want to freeze the situation in a moment of balance that is disadvantageous to whoever is advocating the violence. So even in what seemed like a benign sort of orientation to their coverage, and one that they were unaware of as being biased, academics at least could say, well, there is a bias there that sometimes favors one side and sometimes favors another.
So now let's turn the question on NPR. How do we determine if it has a liberal bias?
It's not so easy. We've actually talked about this a number of times. There are ways to do it, but it's going to be pretty limited. We've done some studies that look at the tone of coverage at different moments. We've done campaign coverage. The last 2 months of the 2008 campaign, I actually asked my staff today to go through that. We never broke out NPR's coverage as an independent news organization in that study. So we're running those numbers now. We did coverage of healthcare reform, and we could look and see whether NPR deviated from the norm in its use of different language on healthcare. The other thing that we did last year in our biannual consumption survey is we asked people why they went to different news outlets.
So when you go through the material you have to see if you can break out NPR's reporting on particular issues, will you share that with us?
Yes, and hopefully we'll have that very soon.
Tom, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Tom Rosensteel is the director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. Coming up, we hear what conservative listeners found in their diaries, and from a self-described progressive media watchdog that counted NPR's talking heads.
And what we found was a very strong slant in favor of the GOP.
This is On the Media. And now, in the midst of all of this partisan rhetoric, we have a reminder that On the Media has relaunched its Media Scrutiny Theater series. What's Media Scrutiny Theater? Well, it's our take on the late, great Mystery Science Theater, which was basically the silhouettes of one human and two robots in front of a big screen in a dark theater, making fun of bad science fiction films. Since a few years ago, the Wall Street Journal dubbed us the irrepressibly snide duo, we thought we might as well apply that talent to what are indisputably the worst short films of the season, the current crop of political ads. It's not all snark, because, you know, we have a few fact checks, but we thought a little video would make the necessary confrontation with the good, the bad, and the ugly go down a little easier.
We are Americans, likely voters in the swing states of Iowa and Wisconsin.
Retirement. This is in black and white, so they're obviously evil.
As president, Barack Obama has never visited Israel.
Or Gaza, Lebanon, Argentina.
Sweden, Hungary.
Poland, Disney World.
Duh, it's all Romney's fault.
I do not think Mitt Romney is concerned.
Murderer!
Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And that is who?
So check out Media Scrutiny Theater. You'll find it at onthemedia.org/blogs/MST.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with the third part of our special hour on liberal bias and public radio. During the course of this exercise, we asked conservative listeners to keep diaries that could track evidence of bias as they saw it. In every case, they said that they were less irked by bias than by public radio's seeming unwillingness to admit it. First, we'll return to listener Sam Negus, who says he rarely, if ever, hears his own views on public radio. In the diary he kept for us, he noted bias in this Morning Edition story that contrasted the immigration policies of Arizona and Utah.
I'm Renee Montaigne. Arizona's tough immigration law has received extensive coverage, and there's been a lot of talk about similar measures in other states. Yet one of Arizona's neighbors, also known for its conservative politics, has taken a very different approach. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports.
If you were to choose a state that would allow illegal immigrants to come out of the shadows, work, and drive without fear of deportation, you probably wouldn't pick Utah.
Okay, is that a fair snippet?
Yeah, I think that was pretty accurate of why I wrote that down. It didn't offend me. I'm an immigrant myself, so I don't have a problem with immigration. But I think there would be a lot of conservative voters, a lot of Republican voters in Arizona who would have heard that and been maybe offended or alienated and certainly would have perceived a bias towards one side or another.
Was there anything inaccurate in what you heard in the piece? Or is this, once again, a question of tone?
I think it was a question of tone. I think the piece was great. I thought it was just very exemplary of the way in which NPR's news coverage can kind of drift towards one side of an issue or another. The piece doesn't consider to the same degree the feelings of U.S. citizens in the state of Arizona who feel alienated or upset for whatever reason that there is this enormous population of undocumented migrant workers in their state.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that if I were a kind of mainline Republican voter in the state of Arizona and I associated with that policy, I would hear NPR telling me the policy that you like is bad and the one that we like is this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what that piece was saying.
Sam said that he found keeping a diary a useful exercise because it put his own perceptions to the test.
I'm not changing my perception that NPR is kind of coming from the left. I do hear that, but it's one thing to kind of hear a tone or a preference. It's another thing to actually have a solid statement that you could put down in a court of law and say, Your Honor, this person said this. So when you do listen to those news shows, and I listened to a bunch of news shows this week, and I felt like, yeah, I can still kind of hear that, but how would I go about proving it? And if you can't really kind of prove it in that concrete way, then that's the space in which you have to start thinking, okay, to what degree is my sensitivity a factor in pinning this issue down?
That was Sam Negus. Kevin Putt, a lifelong conservative, found bias in a question asked by All Things Considered co-host Michelle Norris. She was interviewing Intel CEO Paul Ottolini on a proposal that corporations that build factories in the U.S. be given a 5-year tax holiday. The question that Kevin Putt objected to was also noted by the conservative media criticism site Newsbusters, which called it a liberal question that demonstrated liberal skepticism.
Her question, which isn't unreasonable, her question was, can the country afford that right now?
Let's listen to that.
Anyone that wants to build a new factory in this country, whether it's an American firm or a foreign firm, why don't we give them a 5-year tax holiday? It doesn't cost anything, right? You're just deferring the tax revenues that you would ordinarily get. But meanwhile, you get a factory and you get jobs. And everybody wins.
Can this country afford that right now?
Well, it doesn't cost anything.
Let me tell you what I just heard.
Okay.
As a reporter, I heard a reporter asking a very natural follow-up question that you would ask anybody.
Right. Well, to me, it sounded like a presumption that foregoing any tax revenue right now is a bad policy idea. And that is associated, from my perspective, with a liberal point of view. Sometimes bias, you know, shows up very subtly in the buried premise of a narrative. That's what I think was happening with Michelle.
Do you think she would have been doing her job if she hadn't asked the question?
Oh, easily. She could have had that interview without asking the question, can the country afford that right now? I mean, obviously, you don't hear it that way because you're disagreeing with me. But my ear definitely heard it that way. And I go back to the spending taxing debate that Congress is dealing with, and there are two sides to it. Are we spending too much? Are we taxing too little? And her question had to do with foregoing tax revenue.
But you heard both sides.
Oh, so your point of view is that if he had the opportunity to respond to it, then that would be your concept of there not being any bias. It's not that it's bad reporting. I think it's good reporting. I'm a fan, so it's not like when I hear it, it turns me off. It just comes with the territory.
That was Kevin Putt. Among our critics, there were also a fair number of liberals who felt NPR actually leaned the other way. Next up, Steve Rendell, senior analyst at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, a liberal organization that monitors media bias. In a controversial study released in 2004, FAIR counted up the liberal and conservative sources cited in news reports on Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
And what we found was a very strong slant in favor of the GOP. 61% of partisan guests who appeared on those two NPR shows in 2003 were Republicans.
There was a Republican Congress. There was a Republican White House. I mean, doesn't that make sense?
You should see a few more Republicans on, but the number was 61% Republicans to 38% Democrats. And we were repeating a study that we had done in 1993 when the Democrats had the White House and both houses of Congress. And in that study, we found that there was the same bias, 57% Republicans at that time and 42% Democrats. So it didn't matter who was dominating Washington, Republicans had more guests.
Now, I'm assuming that at least a third of our listeners, the third that identify as conservatives, and maybe a good number of the liberal listeners, too, are thinking, you're a liberal research organization. You make no bones about it. Why should we trust what you say?
Well, our studies are replicable. You can check the numbers. Everybody comes from a point of view. But the thing is, we've had four decades of formal campaigning by the right, by groups like Accuracy in Media, the Media Research Center, the Heritage Foundation, to portray our media, corporate and public broadcasting, as being to the left of center. It's paid off. And I think the fact that we're having this discussion here, the fact that there's a debate in Congress, shows how much it's paid off.
And not because there's a kernel of truth in it.
Well, I would love to see the studies. I have looked at the studies, I have combed the literature, and I just haven't seen anything that really shows that to be true.
That was Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And here's another study. Tim Gross-Close, a professor in the Economics and Political Science Department at UCLA, and Jeff Milieu, an economics professor at the University of Missouri, analyzed 20 mainstream news outlets, counting each time they cited a think tank or policy group in a news story. They gauged the political stripe of a think tank by how many times it was cited by a conservative or a liberal member of Congress. The congresspeople themselves were rated based on their roll call votes. So, bear with me here. Let's say that based on her votes, Michelle Bachmann is deemed the most conservative member of Congress, and she has a serious habit of citing the Christian Coalition, and so does the New York Times. The New York Times would thus be deemed to have a conservative bias equivalent to Bachmann's conservatism. But that's a hypothetical. The Times doesn't have a conservative bias. In fact, based on this criteria, 18 of the 20 media outlets studied were liberal. The most liberal, based on news coverage, the Wall Street Journal. And what of NPR? Morning Edition was certainly rated as liberal, but no more liberal than Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, and slightly less liberal than The Washington Post, and much less liberal than the New York Times. The PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer was closest to the center, as unbiased as any of the news outlets measured. And some more data for your delectation. Last week, we spoke to Tom Rosensteel of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, part of the Pew Research Center. The project researches media bias all the time and vowed to return this week with some data specifically related to NPR. One study assessed the coverage of 50 news outlets of President Obama's first 100 days in office. Rosensteel looked to see how NPR stacked up.
28% of the stories on NPR were positive about Obama versus 37% in the media generally. 52% of NPR's stories were neutral or mixed versus 40% in the media overall. And 21% of NPR's stories about Obama were negative versus 23% with the media generally. So in this case, the bias of NPR, at least according to these findings, would be toward more neutrality than the media generally.
What about NPR's supposed bias towards liberal issues, say race and gender and gay issues?
For 2010, 1% of the time studied on NPR was devoted to those issues. That was exactly the same percentage as we found on commercial headline services, the CBS and ABC headlines that you hear at the top of the hour. Talk radio, which is dominated by conservatives, actually devoted twice as much time to those issues as NPR did in 2010.
Let's return again then to NPR's coverage of President Obama. Conservatives say that Obama gets a lot more press on NPR. How much coverage was there compared to talk radio?
1% of the coverage on NPR last year was focused squarely on Obama. That was the same, again, as on the headline services. But that's about a tenth of what we get on talk radio. And this is typical. What we see in talk radio, and we see it in cable news as well, is that wedge issues that relate to areas of controversy or agitation get more coverage. NPR is more focused on international affairs. They're more focused on sort of explanatory sorts of coverage. There's lots of examples in the data here of spending more time on stories about things like Afghanistan and less time than some other parts of the media, particularly the more commentary or ideological components of the media, on divisive issues like healthcare reform or even the economy. There's less coverage of the economy on NPR and more coverage of policy issues.
Now, you referred last week to a consumption study. Could you share that?
Yes, this is a part of a survey that we do with our colleagues at the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press every 2 years called the Media Consumption Survey. And we asked a number of things, including what it is that regular users of any outlet like about that particular outlet. We asked, do you go there for the latest headlines, for in-depth reporting, for views and opinions, or for entertainment? And NPR stood out on that question in that it was the only outlet where the number one reason that people went to that site was for a mix of all of those things. It was, in fact, the only outlet that was in double digits across all these categories. Another thing that we see that's interesting about NPR is that it doesn't skew toward any particular age group. 11% of Americans overall listen to NPR, our regular listeners to NPR. 11% of those who are 18 to 29 listen to NPR. 12% of those who are 30 to 49. 12% of those who are 50 to 64. And 10% of those 65 and older listen to NPR. This is very unusual. Now, NPR's audience is a more liberal audience than conservative, but not dramatically so. It skews 2-to-1 Democrat versus Republican, but that is not a particularly unusual percentage. Sean Hannity skews 15-to-1 Republican versus Democrat. The New York Times skews 4-to-1 Democrat versus Republican. The only outlets that tend to reflect the population across the board without any ideological tilt at all are ones that are community-based. So local TV news, people's local newspaper.
So help me out here, Tom. Stake your ground. Is NPR biased?
I don't think that our data can answer that question. On story selection, NPR is more international in its focus, clearly. You are going to hear somewhat more about policy. You are going to hear somewhat less about political argument. Does that represent bias? Ultimately, I think these questions of bias may be in the eye of the beholder.
Okay. And taking all of that into consideration, just one last question. Is NPR biased?
I think every listener in the end has to determine that for themselves.
Okay, but do you think NPR is biased?
Brooke, I'm not going to answer that way.
Why not? You've looked at the coverage of politics. You've looked at a variety of heavily freighted issues.
Do I see proof of bias in the story selection? No. Do I see evidence in our tone studies that prove a liberal bias? No. Does this prove that NPR is not biased? I can't say that. We don't have tone for every topic. In the end, it's very hard to establish, even if someone were to identify who's on the air and what their political affiliations are. If you have a lot of people from one party on and the questioning is very tough, that goes one way. And if you have a lot of people on and the coverage are a bunch of softball questions, that goes another way. Bias in the end is often a matter of whether things are phrased in ways that I agree with or disagree with. In the end, you're not going to persuade anyone with data.
Tom, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Well, Ira, now you've heard everything that everyone else has heard. So do you think it'll change anything that you do?
I have to say, I do think it will. Although, by all the numbers that you can measure it, we seem to be about as unbiased as you can be. I understand that around the edges of things, our conservative listeners get a whiff. They hear a tone. They are hearing things that make them wince. And, you know, some of those things, like Michelle Norris asking, can the country afford it? I understand why the conservatives hear it the way they do. But I would ask them, can't you honestly imagine that same question coming from one of the Fox News people in the same situation, or a conservative journalist or a blogger, and wouldn't it feel different to you because of who's asking it? But that said, I feel like the listeners are hearing something that's like making them wince, and I feel like we don't need to make them wince. We just don't.
I come out of it with a sense that this is a mountain that we will never reach the top of.
Yeah.
So I think you just have to keep asking the questions and accept that some listeners will keep listening, even as they wince.
Like, I would imagine that Michelle Norris would have asked the same question if she had a liberal on, saying that they wanted to spend some government money on some big program.
Do you think that any of this will change anybody's mind?
Well, probably not. But, you know, like, it may, you know, nudge people a little bit, and I don't know. Like, no, actually, no. Now that I say that, the answer is no.
In a weird way, I was sort of hoping that we would determined that the news programs were biased.
Why is that?
Because then our credibility as a program would be so much higher.
It's good for On the Media, sure. That's great for you and your little show, for you and Bob. You guys can be the one fair-minded people in public radio. That's great.
Ira, thanks so much. It's been great having you here.
It's been great being here, and it's been fascinating seeing what you guys have come up with.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Mythili Rao, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week is Andrew Dunn. Catcher Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can find the program at onthemedia.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.